I have a wonderful picture of my name in lights in the marquee of Madison Square Garden. And I'm like, oh my God, we'll have to hang that. But I'm often reminded when I see that in my office that my name was in the marquee at Mandalay Bay, Madison Square Garden. And those nights don't quite even hold a candle to being in downtown Buffalo, which is not even a fight town, and having 20,000 of your friends, neighbors, fans, and community behind you. You want to talk about pressure, you know? I mean, that's pressure, you know? That's real pressure. Yeah, financially, maybe would that have made sense? I would have been a circus. The brain-damaged kid's going to be, you know what I mean? Like, what is he, hungry for money? I didn't want people to think that of me. It's not the only reason I boxed, and I wasn't hungry for money. There's a quick email about Brock Lesnar for a second. Why don't I box him? And at that time, I thought, look, I'm just a local draw. Yeah, it's Friday night fights. I'm the main event. I've been fighting on Friday night fights as a co-feature and a main event a little bit, but I still think, and it's fun for Buffalo. We'll see how long Joe lasts, you know?
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Chris Dix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Live Stories. This week, I've been in Buffalo in upstate New York to spend time with former heavyweight contender, Baby Joe Messi. Joe has moved away from the public eye, seemingly, working in healthcare and spending time with his family. But he's still into boxing, though, and is rightly very proud of his career. He retired with a record of, in the region of, I think, 37-0, but he had a career of two halves, really. He beat several contenders, including Davao Williamson, Monty Barrett, and Vasily Girov. And then after the bruising Girov encounter, he suffered maybe at least two subdural hematomas on his brain and was not licensed to fight in many major states again. However, if you listen to this podcast regularly, or if you've read Damage, my recent book, you'll know all about the many loopholes in this sport, and Joe fought several more times. But before you roll your eyes at that, this was a fascinating interview about fighting, ethics, knowledge, wisdom, and strength. And I know people will talk about the levels of honesty associated with this podcast, or people do. Well, you will hear in this that Joe actually takes me aback a couple of times with the things he says and his honesty about a number of different topics. We talked about his career, both parts of it, his life in Buffalo before, during, and after boxing, and what he's up to now. And it was great to spend time with Joe, who comes across as a super humble and very pleasant guy. I really enjoyed speaking to him. But before I leave you with Joe, I wanted to thank my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. I'm also up on Patreon, so if you have any inclination to support this podcast moving forward, you can find me at patreon.com/Tristix, and where you can get future episodes up already. But anyway, here's the brilliant Joe Messi. Joe, thanks for meeting me. I really appreciate it. It's good to see you looking well. How is life now?
It's great, Tris, and thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be on your show. Life is great. I mean, it couldn't be better. You know, I'm a family man now, married to my beautiful wife, Michelle, since 2008. And I've got three beautiful children. Hope is my stepdaughter. She's 24. And my daughter is Juliet. She's 12. My son is 10. His name is Joseph. And I'm loving life, man. I just love being a family man, and it's my priority, and it's what I'm on earth to do.
Do you follow boxing now at all?
I do. Not as much as I used to, but I'm still a huge fan. I love the sport. I'll always love the sport. I'm not as involved as in the sport, obviously, as I used to be. I guess that's intentional. But look, do I force my wife to fall asleep watching boxing three nights a week? Yeah, I'm sure of it. I'm still a fan of the sport.
Yeah. And then you moved into politics for a while, right? Is that still a thing or not?
No, that was brief. That was 2008. Actually, the year of 2007, I ran for New York State Senator. That was a year-long campaign. Won the primary. The general election didn't work out as planned, but it was a wonderful experience for me. I learned a lot. I love government and I love politics. I love this area. I love this community. I love the people. So would I ever say never? Would I run again? The answer to that is unknown. But right now, it's not in the cards, no.
You retired 36-0. Were you satisfied with your career and what happened?
At the time, no. At the time, absolutely not. I was really disgruntled. You know, with the sport, with the business, not the sport. I love the sport. With the business of the sport. Of course, I was younger. I was more immature. I was more focused on that goal and that dream. But today, years later, I'm extremely happy.
Yeah.
Because my eyes are open.
So when you walked away, what did you do in the interim in those years? I think 2007 maybe was the last one. So what happened sort of after that for the next few years? Did you go into like a depressive wilderness where your dream hadn't worked out? Like, were those years tough?
To be honest, the depressive wilderness that you speak of were the years during the Nevada State Athletic Commission hearings, which would have been 2005 and 2006. Those are the years I was basically officially sidelined. During the discussions, the back and forth to Nevada with the state Supreme Court, I kind of assumed I would never fight again. That was the time I was number one in the world. That was the time I was supposed to be in line for Klitschko, negotiations with Mike Tyson. That was the depressive years. That was the years I have some regrets. That was the years I kind of let myself go. I knew, it was over. And after all that long, hard work, what was I going to do beyond boxing to make me happy? So that was the tough years. Now, as we do know, I did get to fight again. I guess, in a sense, winning that hearing to a certain extent, not really winning. But I did fight a few more times. I got a little bit of excitement. But also in the back of my mind, I knew I would never get the shot that I had worked so hard for.
So we'll come to that, Joe. But when it all started, like, what took you to the gym in the first place? Why did you go to boxing? Because this isn't a boxing hotbed. Aside from Joey Giambra, who I knew and met in Las Vegas a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
The Buffalo Adonis. It's not a boxing hotbed up here, right?
It's not. Well, it's not in that type of sense. This is not Philadelphia. This is not Las Vegas, obviously. Atlanta. Some big boxing towns. But boxing, Buffalo, I'm sorry, does have 6 former world champions. Granted, this is early 1900s. And in the years of the 40s, 50s, 60s, Buffalo and boxing has a rich history here. You know, where the Golden Gloves, for example, would sell out arenas. That was a different era, of course. We had a few decent names, local celebs, I should say. One of which was my grandfather, Tom Macy. His son, my uncle, Russell, and they were boxers, Golden Gloves champions, short, brief professional careers, but both very proud of their clippings, you know? So my brother and I, growing up, loved to see their dusty boxing equipment, their wrinkled up clippings, and they fought during that popular era.
Okay.
When boxing was a true sport and a very active sport. You'd fight multiple times a night, and they fought during that era, and it interested my brother and I. Never thought we'd do it. It just interested us.
Did you look up to other fighters, or was it family members that you looked up to when you were a kid? Were there young? Were there guys that you were like, wow, these guys are impressive?
Well, it wasn't until the 80s where I could first remember my father, his brother, and my uncle would host people at our home for the big fights. I mean, Muhammad Ali, Larry Holmes, that's basically how far I go back. And then, of course, the late 80s, early Mike Tyson, and these fights we would host at our house.
Okay.
Just knowing that my family liked boxing and had a history way, way back.
Yeah.
Not ever thinking me or my brother would ever put gloves on. We just enjoyed the sport.
Were you a good kid or were you a tearaway?
No, I was a good kid. When I run into folks that today that knew me as a kid that I hadn't seen in years are still surprised that I took the path I did. I think that because I could say for myself, I was very gentle. I was soft-spoken, almost on the shy side. But I had this other side of me that was very competitive and tough. Not athletic, Tris. That's an opposite. I was not athletic. I played football. I wrestled. I played baseball. I was never the star. I just played. I was always very small, believe it or not. I was very underdeveloped. My puberty.
Was that where Baby Joe came from?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly right. My brother was the athletic, skillful, natural, handsome prom king. I was just young, chubby, pinch his cheeks, and tagged along. Severely underdeveloped in the sense I was just small and chubby all through high school, short even. And that made me, I think back now, and that's what made me as tough and competitive as I am today, because I look back and I always had to hang with the tougher, older, more skillful kids, athletes, whatever you want to call it, because that's what made me who I am, because I always had to hang with them.
Did you get bullied for that stuff or not?
A little bit, early on. Thank God for an older brother, but a little bit. Early on, I did.
Did he bail you out with some scrapes?
Yeah. multiple times, yes.
So you sort of mentioned, obviously, the size and strength. Were you good at boxing from the start, or was it a hard learning curve for you?
No, that's the thing. I didn't have the skill. I don't think I had any natural ability. Boxing ability, boxing knowledge, I should say. But, you know, as I speak to some of the young kids in this community, you know, talent and skill is the least important when it comes to an ability or a task, you know. It's more of a work ethic and dedication and motivation. Those are the characteristics that are most important. Those are the characteristics I had from day one. Ability and skill was not that.
So how old were you when you had your first amateur fight, and what happened?
I was 18 or 19, maybe 19 years old. This was after high school, after my athletic days have kind of come to an end. And my brother and I, my father, Buffalo policeman, said, why don't you go to the police athletic league gym? It's free, and you guys can pound each other there instead of at the house. Just get out of here. And we did. And we did just that. And that really snowballed. We enjoyed it. And we started sparring. And I got my little amateur USA card. And I had my first couple of fights that I won. Again, not out of skill, per se, but just pure toughness, I guess. It was more of a tough man contest.
And you had about 75 amateur fights when it was all said and done, right?
Yeah, maybe even more. Yeah, yeah, I'd say so.
And among the notables that you boxed, you fought Hesse Rettman in the amateurs, right?
I did. That was kind of a remarkable day, because that's kind of when I thought I might have a little something to, not even to turn pro at the time, just to have a little bit of an amateur career. Maybe I could win a national tournament. Maybe I could attempt to try for the Olympics, which would be in a year or two, or 1996 at that next one. So that's kind of when I thought I was winning state titles, Golden Gloves, Empire State Games. And that's kind of when I thought, maybe I'll take this a little further. I was just having fun at the time.
And you wound up having a rivalry with Lawrence Klebe, who you fought at least three times, right?
Yeah, at least three times. Yeah, I've always looked up to Lawrence Klebe. He's like a name not to be forgotten. He, in my eyes, skillfully, let's talk about that talent, skillfully one of the best heavyweights I think I remember. And remember, at the time, gosh, Lawrence was a man. Lawrence was in his 30s at the time. I could be mistaken, mid-30s. I was a young boy, 22, you know.
Who developed late anyway.
Yeah, a late developer. And I always looked up to him, not only, and like one of the kindest gentlemen, too. I always liked Lawrence. And he taught me a lot on our USA national tours. We were traveling together, he and DeVera Williamson. Taught me a lot as the newcomer along to the USA team, you know. So I've always had a lot of respect for Lawrence Klebe.
So he was ultimately your hurdle, wasn't he, that stopped you going to the Olympics? But you were the alternate, that's right.
Correct. Yeah. He was the last gatekeeper. In 1996, I remember the invite to Oakland, California, Tris, and that was a tough week. I didn't know what to expect of that week. I was honored and surprised just to be there. Charles Shuford, these are names, Alvin Knox, Whitaker, Lance Whitaker, huge guy. I mean, these were big names in that year, and I had to fight every night, I think for six nights, and I won the first five, and I kind of see was as shocked as everybody else. Tom Martin, and it came down to Lawrence Klebe and I kind of knew I was in over my head, and Lawrence proved it that night. He had won by points. But what happens after the Olympic qualifiers, you get to go home, the two finalists, which would have been Lawrence Klebe and myself. Everybody else is excluded. You go home for a couple weeks, and you come back to the nationally televised Olympic box office in Augusta, Georgia then. Lawrence had to win one night where I had to win two in a row because I had lost previously. So as you know, I went home and trained hard thinking I got to beat this guy who I've always looked up to two nights in a row, and it's going to be a challenge. Well, the first night came around and I was incredibly determined, and I won by such a big margin by points. I'll tell you, that night, I remember going back, I got a little cocky as a youngster. I thought, my God, I won so easily, and I'm going to the Olympics. All I got to do is win one more fight tomorrow. And Lawrence knew differently. He had stopped me there. I think it was the first round. That's the first time I'd ever been like knocked down, or really, it was an eye opener. I mean, after a while, you start thinking, man, I can get hit by anything and not get hurt. And he hurt me pretty good, and they stopped the fight, rightfully so. And deservingly, he went on, and I was the Olympic alternate. But I learned a lot from that mentally, you know?
So was part of you hoping he would get injured and wouldn't go?
No.
You've got to say that.
No. I mean, no. So, but you know what? What became one of the best summers of my life, Tris, was that summer, the Olympians, 12 Olympians, including Fernando Vargas, Floyd Mayweather, Antonio Tarver, a great team, and us 12 alternates traveled together internationally.
Right.
And that might have turned out to be one of the best 3 months. I mean, it was just incredible. A great experience.
Did you peg Floyd Mayweather for superstardom back then?
I knew he'd be world champion.
Yeah.
Did I know he'd be the greatest ever? I didn't know that. But again, deservingly so, he is just that.
So when you turned pro, what was the dream then? What was the goal? To be a world champion?
Not even yet.
No. Just to make some money?
I remember sitting at the kitchen table with my mother was still alive then, and my father, and Tris, I always thought I'd be a police officer. My grandfather was a police officer who boxed. My father was. And I was at the age of my life, I had a letter in front of me from the New York State Police saying I passed the test and the physical aspects and I could start the academy. And I had to make a decision. You know, am I going to pass up this wonderful job opportunity or am I going to like dedicate myself? Because either I'm doing one or the other. Mm-hmm. And I chose boxing. So I decided to forfeit that letter and opportunity. I said, I'll take a few professional fights. I had a manager lined up, Bob Spagnola, including my father, Jack Macy. And I said, I'll probably get beat and we'll just go back and beg for that opportunity again or something. And then again, you know the history. It snowballed from there.
So you turned pro in 97 in New York on a big bill with Haseem Rahman, who was 23-0 at the time. So he'd already had a head start in the pros.
Yeah.
Lou Savarese, who was 36-1. David Izon, who would become an old mate, 19-2. Monty Barrett, who was 11-0. And Jamil McLean, who was actually a bit of a spotty 6-2-1 at the time.
Yeah.
So plenty of contenders and hopefuls on that. And you stopped Dwayne Allen in round one. So a good start and a good platform for you to get your name in amongst some guys who are making waves in the division.
That's right. That was a great pro debut card. That was an HBO show that I got the honor to be just on the undercard, not televised, of course. And my dear friend that I met just months before that, I'm still dear friends with Lou Savarese.
Yeah.
We became training partners and sparring partners because we shared Bob Spagnola on our teams. And Bob, again, with my father Jack, made a wonderful team and protector of me, as we all say, during that climb. But that was a great debut because it was a wonderful show. I mean, a lot of coincidences because later on I went to fight David Izon later in my career, who was on that card. I think it was like a heavyweight showcase. And I thought it was a big deal, you know? And I think it was Dwayne Kaysen. A little tougher opponent than I wanted for my opening, but it worked out well.
So you had 7 fights in 98, a year on. So what was the thought process? Was it to be moved quickly, or was it to learn as much as you could on the job?
That was my learning phase.
Yep. Almost Tyson-esque, really, because in terms of, you know, being out there regularly.
I had a long talk, and I think Bob Spagnola and my father, Jack, agreed, and this was the goal. Look, from age... When boxing, from age 20 to 24, 4 years, I went from a beginner to an Olympic alternate. I mean, that's fairly quick. Mm. These other guys, whether they were Olympians or alternates, these 24 guys I traveled with and got to know quite well, I always used to look around quietly and say, these guys have had gloves on since they were 8 years old, maybe 12, okay? I started as a fluke, as an exercise, when I was 19, you know? I was new to the sport, new to the business. Back in the amateur days on the U.S. team, I surprised everyone. Everyone wondered who the newcomer is. And I saw myself as relatively new to the game and a lot to learn within the ring. Mm.
So... In 1999, you had at least 5 fights. You picked up the New York State Athletic Heavyweight title against Anthony Green. That title mean anything to you?
Well, sure. It did, of course, then, because of obvious reasons. It's part of the climb. And it does today because when you learn about the history and the fighters that held that title, I mean, the huge names. I mean, you know, I think... huge boxing names and historical names had to take that path to grasp a New York State title before moving on to a continental or North American or even a world title. So it meant I'm climbing the scale correctly.
And one of those early bouts was in the Blue Horizon, the historic Blue Horizon in Philly. Did that mean anything to you, boxing in one of boxing's churches?
It did, because, you know, now at the age of 18 and 19, and even before this, Tuesday night fights were my life. I loved watching Tuesday night fights. Then, of course, moved to Friday night fights. But I know my dad and his brother, they would go back to the Gillette days, watching the Gillette fights here in America weekly. And there was plentiful boxing then, weekly boxing, not like today, you know? So I loved watching the Tuesday night fights. And you know, the Horizon was hosting once a month at least, right? So I always thought, I was an amateur. I'm just a Golden Glover at the time, and watching those, going, man, that would be incredible. Like one day, it would just be incredible one day to, even if I lost, just to go there and say I fought there, you know?
In 2001, you scored something of a breakout win over the Cuban veteran Jorge Luis Gonzalez. Agree that was sort of the big step?
I think so. He and Bert Cooper, both of which were at the same venue in Niagara Falls, New York, not too far from here. As you are on the climb, you obviously have to go after those guys that have a strong history. They might have a little age to them. They might even have a world title. They might be on their way out, but you got to get past that, because if you don't, you know, it might be time to hang it up.
Yeah, and they get another go-around if they knock off a prospect like you, too.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's a test that has to be passed, and there has to be a handful of those. And those, Bert Cooper and Gonzalez, was just that. And I was nervous for Gonzalez as his height difference, but he certainly packed a punch. But I had known at that time, these are guys that I'm just better conditioned for and could take.
That Gonzalez fight, that was on a bill with Razor Ruddock, who wasn't from a million miles from here. Was that ever discussed, you and Razor?
Briefly. And I'll tell you, at the time, he scared me too. When I look at fights, I look at styles. And Tris, I know what styles make me nervous, and I know what styles don't. Some styles make me nervous, and he's got that fluid. I've always admired his movement, Razor Ruddock, and I have in the back of my mind, not the guys I can't beat, guys that I would not be quick to jump. You know, I would fight anybody, Tris, but guys I wouldn't be so quick to jump.
Guys
be
that
so
didn't
excited.
Suit you quite so well.
Yeah, he's one of them. Yeah. But anyway, I know I had a little bit advantage on age, but before we go any further, I have to say, I kept seeing Bob Spagnuolo and my father. The real genius and my secret weapon were my trainers, Juan de Leon, and his brother was Carlos Sugar de Leon, who is now passed, but he was four-time cruiserweight champion from Puerto Rico. I believe the first ever hold the cruiserweight title, created on his behalf. So these de Leon brothers, much of the story is when and how they found me as an amateur fighter late in my amateur career. They were in Buffalo because they have family here. They're very involved in boxing, and they spotted me. And to save a lot of time, we just gelled very well. They saw something in me. I think it was the work ethic and dedication. It wasn't the talent. Because Juan, especially, molded me into that.
Right.
Juan is still a trainer. I think he has two world champions. He's in Puerto Rico now. He is the secret weapon to all of this success, because how I like to say it is, I have the perfect mentality for boxing. I have the ability. I have the motivation. I have the work ethic. But with Juan, we infused some boxing skill. Not much.
But enough. Yeah.
So Juan, without Juan, I don't think, not I don't think, I never would have been able to take the path that I took, because he's the one that infused the boxing sense into me, you know?
Okay. Wow, I didn't know that. I wasn't expecting that. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of natural ability, and I'll give you a good example. We might be getting ahead of ourselves, but Juan saw someone that would work hard. Yeah, I punched hard, or I worked hard. I was focused. I could avoid distractions. And I wanted to learn. I was a good student. I think that's the most important part. I was a good student. But natural ability, athletic and toughness are two different things. You know, I could be taught athleticism. I have that ability. I'm fast for a big man. But Juan infused this boxing skill and how to move the head and how to jab and how to survive in the ring. And he's an incredible, incredible teacher. If he's a true, you look at these trainers today, Emmanuel Stewart, who I love and respect, and Teddy Atlas, love and respect. These names like that, Freddie Roach, they've had multiple world champions. I always have to ask, who did they create from day one? You know, there's maybe one or two. They've always inherited world champions. Are they good trainers? Of course they are. But who can I get to train? It was a perfect storm for me because I needed someone to teach me the basics and then gradually get more challenging and challenging in the learning aspect. And I have a good example of this later on in the interview when we get to a little bit later on in my career.
Were you a good trainer? Did you enjoy it? Did you like to train? You
didn't? I don't. I knew I had a goal. We worked hard, man. We worked so hard. I had to work hard.
Yeah.
I wasn't these other guys. I'm the opposite of a James Toney. You know, he doesn't have to work hard. He should. I mean, he'd be the best fighter who ever lived. But he has natural ability. I don't have. I have no choice. I have to work hard. But it's great because it taught me proper way to live my life, you know?
Sure. You had mentioned Bert Cooper there. Any memories of Bert? What version of Bert did you get? Did you get the erratic one, or did he come out smoking and then sort of go back in his shell? What did you get?
Yeah.
You stopped him in seven.
Bert hurt me round one. Bert hurt me in the first round. I don't think many people saw it in the film, because I watched the film and I'm like, well, there it is. Bert has got three hell of a rounds in him, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
later Bert Cooper. But I remember I watched the Bert Cooper Evander Holyfield fight so many times, and people I think often overlook that fight. It's one of my favorite fights. I mean, you look at the history that Evander Holyfield, my idol, has, and his track record and what he's accomplished, and that is one of the best fights of Evander Holyfield's career, because Bert Cooper is that tough.
Well, Bert also had those incredible bouts with Michael Moore and Ray
Mercer.
That's
right. That's right. Like, he's had it incredible.
And no one made, but you know, Ray Mercer had an iron jaw, ended up with a jaw like a grapefruit, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, Ray Mercer is my favorite uncrowned heavyweight fighter.
Yeah.
No doubt. I ran into him on an airplane a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And we had spotted each other and got to sit with each other.
You ever sparred with Ray?
No, I never sparred with Ray.
Okay.
And it was one of it was actually at a few events of mine when I was inducted into the New York State Boxing Hall of Fame. He was there as a guest. But it was just funny how we ran into each other on an airplane and shared a ride and got to chat. And just a great, great guy, great fighter, great human being.
So you were 22-0 after beating fellow contender David Izon. That was in Buffalo. How popular were you in Buffalo then at that point? I mean, people were calling you the third franchise behind with the Bills and the Sabres. Was it crazy?
It was. You know, Bob Spagnuolo being the manager of my boxing career, my father was the manager. I want to say he was the marketing genius. Early on, Buffalo is a small town of wonderful, loyal people. The people here adore the Buffalo Bills. They adore the Buffalo Sabres and the National Hockey League. They love their sports. It's a community that comes together in the time of need. And my dad knew this, being a Buffalo police officer. So when I was gaining some news clippings as an amateur fighter, and gaining a little popularity. I would do a TV morning show or go to a fundraiser. This was all part of his genius, and it got me heavily involved in the community. I didn't understand why then so much. I was touring Children's Hospital with a couple of former athletes, professional athletes, and doing things of that nature. And that also taught me a lot and matured me, realizing there's more to life than just, you know, boxing and myself and what I'm doing. It really opened my eyes. That's the best part of what my dad taught me. But in doing so, in doing all that, as my early professional career was developing, I was still being very active in the community when I was in town. And again, that's what paid off.
Sure.
I always say it this way, you know, again, without getting too far ahead of ourselves, every fighter, professional fighter in the world, has the dream and goal to fight at Madison Square Garden and to fight at MGM and Mandalay Bay and all these wonderful venues. And I got to do all that. Fighting in Buffalo is nothing tops it.
Did you feel legit at this stage? Did you feel that you were a legit heavyweight contender, or were you concerned that people saw you as this sort of manicure contender?
Right then, right around then, when I fought at University of Buffalo, not too far from here, Tris, on ESPN. Sugar Ray Leonard at the time was my promoter. And at that time, I thought, look, I'm just a local draw. Yeah, it's Friday night fights. I'm the main event. I've been fighting on Friday night fights as a co-feature and a main event a little bit. But I still think, and it's fun for Buffalo. We'll see how long Joe lasts, you know?
Yeah. So you had that in the back of your mind that people were skeptical?
Yeah. Yeah.
So did that give you motivation?
But Tris, I was skeptical. I don't know. I don't know.
That's so honest of you. But
I don't know. I was also skeptical. I wasn't that confident.
What about when you beat Devarrell Williamson? So you beat him in like 2 minutes, and you mentioned obviously at the start he was in the Olympic team with you, in the US team. That's a big win. That's that sort of stuff. You've beaten David Izon, you've beaten those two gatekeepers, Burt Cooper and Gonzalez, and now you've beaten Izon and Williamson in quick order. Like, do you start to believe in yourself with these victories? Or are you still not all in?
I started, you know, it was right about then when we had the three larger fights in downtown Buffalo, televised on ESPN and HBO, first of which was David Izon. I started to believe myself in the sense, I mean, there was like 19,000 people there, and I started to believe myself as the real marketing trend. Like, I do have support. These people want me to win. They want me to do good. And then beating Izon was a big deal for me because, again, looking back to my first fight, my pro debut, he was the main event. And I got to watch him thinking, my God, this guy's going to be one of my targets down the road. And he was. So that was a big deal for me to see my maturity through the years and my skill level increase. Then, of course, the following fight in Buffalo was Robert Davis. Also a pretty big name in the heavyweight division at the time. We had sparred a little bit a couple years prior, and he whooped me around a little bit because he was on top at the time. So, yeah, I was a little nervous for that fight, but I knew I was ready. And I knew all along, and this is kind of coming together, I'm progressing as a fighter, thanks to Juan, my trainer.
Right.
I'm becoming something. I'm learning something from each fight. I'm bringing something with me from each fight because of my training team. And I think these guys are still the same fighter they were from day one. Nothing wrong. I'm not criticizing.
No.
I'm just progressing, and I don't think that they are.
Sure. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. So did you do training camps, or were you just training year-round? Were you always in the gym with these guys?
No, I did training camps. We spent a lot of time in Houston with Lou Savarese. I spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico, Juan's hometown.
In fact, I saw that there was, I think maybe it was the Giro fight where you were training in Tulsa and Vegas as well.
Yeah, Tulsa, because Tony Holden.
Yeah, sure,
Tony Holden.
Sure. We'll come to Tony in a bit.
And Vegas, spent some time. I mean, we would, you know, the weather isn't great here in Buffalo. So summer months, sure, I'd love to stay home and train, but obviously due to the distractions, often it was the snow and the cold, and often it's lack of sparring.
Did you not see Rocky IV?
Well, I'm used to running it in 2 degrees, but there's not a lot of plentiful heavyweight boxing
sure,
here.
Sure.
And those times we did stay in Buffalo, it was quite costly to bring in a lot of heavyweights, put them up in hotels, pay them what they want to pay them. You'd send a guy out, you bring a new guy, I mean, multiple guys. So it was easier for me to go to the where the sparring was.
Sure. Against Monty Barrett, you ran up a big lead and you dropped him in the fifth. But then you were down later on for the first time in your pro career. What went through your mind going down for the first time as a pro?
Well, Tris, first time in a fight, not sparring.
Okay.
I've been all over the floor in sparring.
Oh, really? Really? Okay.
I wouldn't say all over, but I mean...
Any notables put you over? Any guys that we would have heard of?
No.
Who were amongst some of the best that you sparred?
My God. Well, I mean, I've been in there with Evander. I was a pretty popular sparring partner for John Ruiz.
Okay.
But that's what makes it even odder. No, it wasn't the stars that put me down. So, I mean, and of course, you know, Savarese and I think Robert Davis and Izon, these guys we'd all met in the ring somewhere in the gyms and had good sessions. But
I've seen those gym fighters, though, the gym fighters that can't carry it over onto the under the bright lights, right? And so some of the best guys are the guys that are in the gyms that don't cut it in the ring because they just don't have the mentality.
That's exactly
right. But
you've got
some of these dangerous psychopaths in the gyms who are awesome fighters.
And I felt like I was quite the opposite. I don't think I shined in the gym. I had some good sessions, but it was not where I showed my best,
sure.
You know? So I think that, you know, I'd been on the mat, but, you know, Monty, remember earlier I mentioned one of those fighters I've always looked at stylistically, and Monty's one of them.
Mm.
Happy to fight him, happy to jump on it, on the opportunity, because I knew it was the next logical step. But I knew it wouldn't be easy. What many people don't know, I had a cut on my eye 2 weeks before that. It was pretty bad. It was stitched.
Oh, yeah. So 19 days before, it says that you picked up an injury and you stopped sparring. So it was a cut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a great doctor locally. He says, you're going to be fine. But I was also questioning, geez, these last important weeks, I didn't do a whole lot. I came in a little heavier than I wanted to. I don't think I was at 100% for that fight. Not to make excuses, because, I did well the first 7 rounds. But, again, you got to give Monty credit because, I mean, he's got a great resume in history and is hung in there with the best. So I was really proud of that victory, even though the way it happened. But knocking me down, I was hurt. I was hurt that fight. I remember going to the hospital, and much like the Rocky movie, Tris, running into Monty at the hospital, we both went to get checked. A vague, foggy memory, but we've become quite good friends, Monty. He's a complete gentleman. I think that might be the start of my injury.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't say that often publicly. It's been years later. That's my guess.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't medically examined other than a minute. Yeah. I was minimally examined, put it that way.
Yeah.
That's possible anyway.
So that Barrett fight, the press were quite hard on you. Some people saying that you'd been exposed and that kind of stuff.
I think deservingly so.
Well, that's hard. That's harsh for you to say. But also, did you feel like some people were waiting for you to fall? Were thinking that, it's like people build you up and knock you down, right? Especially in media.
As now I'm more older, I didn't view it this way at the time, Tris. But now that I'm older and I have a much better capability of putting myself in other people's shoes, and I can look back on things with less, care.
Yeah,
I guess.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a great word. Less emotion. So, I think, here's a guy. not kind of an undersized, I'm going to say a Caucasian, who has a big local following, you know, big deal, to them anyway. And we're just waiting for him to, let's see him get exposed. I mean, yeah, he's good. He's not Mike Tyson. I mean, so when I, today, I could see people thinking that, and rightfully so.
You mentioned Tyson. It was around about this time there was a big talk about you and Tyson. So you had said that there had been some discussions. I mean, that's a big fight upstate, isn't it, with Tyson's origins in Catskill? And I know he was long since gone, but like...
And that's why I was excited. But, you know, I guess...
Would you have liked this? Did you want that fight?
I did, because if you think about this, moving ahead, right after the Giroff victory, I was number one in the world, and naturally I'd have to fight Klitschko. And, yeah, there was brief through a couple of emails, well, Klitschko, come to Buffalo. And obviously they said no. I would have to go there.
Which Klitschko, either or both? Oh,
Vladimir.
Okay.
Vladimir. And that, you know, I was going to have to go to Germany. So this is kind of right. This is before the injury was really made public.
Right.
They said, we have an option. Because of your draw here in Buffalo, and because Mike at the time, remember this is early 2005, Mike needed some money, not very focused, not very healthy, just quit a couple of fights, but still the draw that he is. I mean, think about it. Which one would you take? So I thought I would take Mike. I would have loved to have fought either or both of the Klitschkos to see where I am. But when financially speaking, you want to bring Mike Tyson to Buffalo.
Hey, so obviously you've paid so much credit to the DeLeons, that put kind of makes one of my questions irrelevant. But with you being a big heavyweight from upstate, you never thought of going to train with Kevin Rooney in the Catskills. And obviously there was this link with Tony Holden, who obviously we mentioned, who managed Tommy Morrison. And Tommy did go and train in Catskill with Kevin Rooney for a while.
He did, but I think everybody in my team was so pleased with what the De Leons were doing, with sure. What Juan was doing. There was no need for that.
There was also talk around this time of you fighting Haseem Rahman again. Was that a fight that you wanted in the pros?
Absolutely. And Haseem and I, through the years, would run into one another. We always kind of laughed and joked about that. Even, Tris, I don't want to say in more recent years, but even after 2007 when I officially kind of retired and hung it up, it was talked about again as, but...
Not just banter.
Yeah.
Just, could, I mean, happen. Yeah.
Why not try to put these two guys together? So
you'd mentioned the Giroff fight. So I understand, going back through the notes, it was a shootout between Giroff and Michael Mora for that fight. And you said you didn't want Michael Mora because if you beat him, you've beaten an old guy. And if you struggle, then you struggle with an old guy. Basically, you saw it as a no win. So you chose Giroff.
Well,
who was coming off the exciting performance against James Toney, albeit off a loss.
Yeah, again, one of the best fights. If you ever want to just watch a boxing match and be entertained,
yeah.
It's literally one of the best
all-time
boxing.
Great cruiserweight fights, isn't it? It's up there with Kawi and Holyfield.
I agree with you. That's an incredible fight. Every round is exciting, and I watched that fight 50 times leading up to mine. But I don't remember the decision between Moore and Giroff. I guess it was a lose-lose either way, because either way, if fighting Giroff, you beat a cruiserweight. I don't look at it that way. I think Giroff with Evander Holyfield is the best cruiserweight who ever lived. I mean, he was undisputed cruiserweight champion with like 18 fights. He's an Olympic gold medalist. I think he won the best boxer in the Olympics.
Yeah, the Val Barker Award, yeah.
I don't know if there's been a cruiserweight since him. Still eager to fight him. The only thing I feared about him, two things, his qualities, left-handed and tough. I don't I knew it would go the distance, probably. He's about, he's like myself, is about as durable as they come, you know? So I was expecting to go to late rounds or go the distance with him. And I knew it would be tough because I'm not skillful against southpaws. They always kind of scared me.
But you didn't find many in the amateurs either, did you?
No.
Understand? Like your exposure to southpaws was tiny.
Yeah, I don't think I've fought many. And again, as I don't have a lot of memory of that fight. And I'll be honest, I haven't even... I could count the times on my one hand how many times I viewed it since then. I just haven't watched it much. But I was kind of proud of myself for how I did the first nine rounds. You know, I wasn't looking for a knockout. I wanted to just control the fight. I don't want to try to knock somebody out. I know he's very tough and durable. I know he's an incredible... He prepares incredibly well. And I just wanted to take him and get the W. And I was very happy with what I did the first nine rounds.
You were chief support to Shane Mosley, Winky Wright. So a massive show in Vegas. Did you like your name up in lights in Vegas and the whole Vegas experience being part of the big fights?
I did.
Was it stressful?
Not as much as being in Buffalo.
Okay.
You know? It's like I said, you know, I have a wonderful picture of my name in lights in the marquee of Madison Square Garden. And I'm like, oh, my God, we'll have to hang that. But I'm often reminded when I see that in my office that my name was in the marquee at Mandalay Bay, Madison Square Garden. And those nights don't quite even hold a candle to being in downtown Buffalo, which is not even a fight town, and having 20,000 of your friends, neighbors, fans, and community behind you. You want to talk about pressure, you know? I mean, that's pressure,
yeah.
You know? That's real pressure. So, but it was great to be spoiled, you know, spending a few months leading up in Las Vegas, and great to be spoiled in New York City. And it was really wonderful experiences, but I can only wish that other fighters would have a similar type of stories like mine to have that background.
It's funny you talk about the pressure, because I've interviewed a few guys on this podcast, and they talk about loving being the center of attention, and they love, I'm not saying the pressure, but they love they just love being maybe the center of attention. Maybe it is that. And that's what really gets them going, and that support really... they sort of grow with it rather than sort of shy away from it. But I know what you're saying, because when I boxed as an amateur, I didn't tell anyone when I had a fight. I would go with my coach and then hope that I would come back with good news. And if I didn't come back with good news, I didn't tell anyone I fought. Because I hated the pressure. I hated the pressure of people knowing, because you know that what's coming is when you tell everyone you've got this fight coming up, the thing that comes after is, how did the fight go? And if you don't tell them you're fighting, you never have to answer the question.
That's an excellent theory. I think I was the same, but I was much the opposite. I had looking back now, I think I shined under that spotlight. Yeah. Again, but as I told you, I wasn't very good in the gym during my private sparring sessions, mm-hmm. Doors locked.
It must be a fear thing, right? Fight or flight.
And I think so.
You bit down and...
I think so. I turned out to be somewhat clutch, so to speak, in that time. I never was that way in my life, but throughout boxing, and I guess you can call it clutch, but you can say it's lucky, but I think it goes with hard work, you know, and preparation. But I get that theory very well, yeah.
Hey, you had mentioned, obviously, being Caucasian. Was race a thing for you in boxing? It sort of comes up because I sat down with Jerry Cooney and Larry Holmes a couple of weeks ago to do this podcast. Was it part of your story, race, the fact that you were a white heavyweight? I mean, is it even part of a conversation?
Well, it's not like I wanted it to be or cared for it to be. But in the sport, it comes with it. I think, you know, just because of the age-old great white hope term, it wasn't really brought up much, though. I don't know if that was more of a 60s, 70s, 80s thing. I don't know. It didn't come up a lot. Look, I was certainly the minority. Yeah. That was known. I was often compared to Tommy Morrison, for example, even Jerry Cooney. Almost similar styles, even. And then, of course, sharing a similar promoter, Tony Holden. But and it wasn't really highlighted.
Did you know Tommy?
I knew Tommy. I knew Tommy. I met Tommy early on in my career through Tony Holden, before he even was promoting me.
Okay.
So we trained together a little bit as I was a young pro. And he's an interesting fellow. And one of the best, if you've watched here in America on ESPN, the 30 for 30s.
Yeah, yeah.
I've watched several of those. That's one of the best ones. He's got a great 30 for 30 story. The ESPN did a nice job highlighting his life.
I went and interviewed Tommy down in Sparta in Tennessee many, many moons ago. It was actually after a heavyweight show. It was after Chris Bird fought Galotta and... Okay. John Ruiz fought Fred Zaquendo in the Garden. The next day, I took the bus out to Sparta in Tennessee. Did you get on well with Tommy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was kind of out there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we fought on the same card. I'm going to tell you, this is after Tommy was sick and his hiatus for a few years. This was after my injury, even, on my little brief comeback.
Yeah.
This is West Virginia. To my surprise, I get to West Virginia, and I think in the main event, I don't know if it was ESPN or a local MSG or what, Tommy's there, and he's fighting, and he fought. And he beat the political system in the sense proving that he was clear of his infectious disease, HIV, and he fought that night. I'm going to tell you, and I loved Tommy for what he did for the sport and for a lot of reasons, and we had some nice quality time together. But I'm going to tell you what I thought, honestly, when I got there and saw Tommy and hugged him and shook his hand. I said, geez, I took a step back and said, here's this commission that's allowed me, the brain damaged fighter, fight, and now it doesn't look so great. Because they're also allowing Tommy Morrison fight.
Who's do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Places. Yeah, yeah.
Do you understand?
You like the Outlaws, yeah, yeah.
It kind of deflated my balloon a little bit in what my attempts were to try to prove myself fight by fight, state by state, license by license, that I do have, that I do fit in still.
Yeah, sure. It made you feel that the show was more about an attraction than a legitimate heavyweight show.
So I remember that. It's unfortunate. It's not personal against Tommy, but I remember, you know, that was not part of my mission.
Yeah, sure. So the Giroff fight, obviously you said you don't remember too much about it, but you won on points, close decision, and you've watched it back, but you struggled to watch it back.
To watch my back?
No, to watch that fight back.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know that. It's not that I don't want to. I've seen the fight. I sure like to, if I'm going to show a fight, I'll show something more exciting. But I don't know. I guess maybe it just reminds me of the beginning of the end, you know?
Yeah. Hey, after that, you were called out by, do you remember this, Juan Carlos Gomez, who apparently sent you a card of a picture of you in a pram. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. Oh my goodness, that's the first I've thought of that in some time.
So I guess you don't have that card up in your office.
That is not. I'll bet. Yeah, I know I have it. I keep everything. Again, lefty. He was a southpaw, right? Was he on Carlos Gomez?
Yeah, I think he was.
I think he was. But I would have liked that too. I would have liked that fight.
You, again, you know, after the Giroff fight.
That's a great memory.
After the Giroff fight, people did write you off. And listen to this from Boxing News magazine, right, in the UK. Put simply, Baby Joe is no longer viable as a heavyweight contender. you were 29-0 and people said you're no longer viable as a heavyweight contender. Is that, was that unfair?
I guess. I think, you know, again, it's the cruiserweight. If Giraffe was a heavyweight, would they have said that? It's the figmentation of the, this guy was 15 pounds lighter than most of the guys I fought. I mean, that's why they think that. So, I mean, one of the best cruiserweights ever lived, one of the best boxers I can think of, like, and the, for people to say that, I guess I get people saying that. Maybe in some sense I was exposed. I'm not sure. But coming off a Barrett fight, also not my best performance, I could see the downward spiral of people thinking, I don't know how much more he's got, you know?
Was there talk in the immediate aftermath about you fighting Girov again? About a rematch?
No, there wasn't.
So when
everything became focused on not even so much, well, the injury and the exposure of the injury.
So, yeah, so tell me, when did, how and when did things start to go wrong? What happened? You had an MRI scan.
I did. It gets complicated, Tris, because I was cleared by the Nevada State Athletic Commission. You come out of the ring, whether you're knocked down or not, they look into your eyes, they tap you on the butt, and they tell you to go home. That's what they did. So I was cleared by Nevada State Athletic Commission. In the shower, I have no memory of post-fight. I don't remember the post-fight party. I don't have much memory of that. We've all been knocked around a little bit. We all know what it's like to be dinged, to be hurt. And this was different. Okay, so now after a few days in Nevada, I went home back to Buffalo right here. And I still wasn't feeling my best. When I thought, let's go see a local neurosurgeon here for some imaging. And I went to my personal doctor. So that's when the injury was discovered.
And so one website I saw said that there were two subdural hematomas. Is that right?
I think so. Two or three small spots, yeah. Very minuscule small.
And then your journey was now about trying to fight again.
Not immediately.
Okay.
I'm not foolish or stupid or naive. I need to do my homework. And people think that because the articles and what was written in the media. But there was a time where I said, geez, what? I knew what concussions were. I didn't know what a subdural hematoma is. I didn't know what a brain hemorrhage is. I wasn't even thinking about it. I know a concussion. That's all I know. So I did my due diligence. I did some homework. I've talked to some doctors. My doctor locally, a neurosurgeon, says, diagnosed what you have. I am at no place to tell you. I don't have the experience, knowledge, or practice to tell you whether or not you are deemable or are fit to fight again. You have to go talk to Julian Bales and Dr. Robert Cantu.
Right.
The two foremost experts with this injury
and
your sport.
Sure.
So I did just that.
Oh, wow. So Dr. Robert Cantu, who I interviewed for a book I've written recently, which is called Damage and about long-term brain injuries in boxing.
I'm well aware.
And Robert is a great guy, right? He's a great doctor and really, really knows his stuff. And he loves boxing as well. He knows his boxing.
And a great friend of mine and a great person. I love he and his wife, Tina. I love him to death.
Oh, wow. So I suppose one thing that we didn't mention here as well is after Girov, I mean, going into Girov was the last fight before the big one, wasn't it? You had to beat Girov, and then 29-0, you were going to get one big fight. I mean, it wasn't known who you were going to be fighting or what, but really he was the last stepping stone to a massive fight, right?
Well, that was our assumption. That was our thought. Look at, you know, Tris, my goal since the day, I mean, I made my pro debut and I started to realize fight by fight, I do have something. I'm still trying to prove it to myself, you know, even. But as it as things escalated, you know what my goal was? I just want to fight for a world title. Winning it to be, I'm not going to become a legend. Hall of Famer. I want guys I'm beating, Devera Williamson and Monty Barrett and Robert David, they've all fought for world titles. Why? I just want an opportunity to fight for a world title. I just want that opportunity. Not the type of guy that signs the contract and, you know, that's where he's figured he's won, you know, like he just wants the pay. I just want to prove myself. I want to fight for a world title. I think I'm going to surprise people. I don't care who it is. I just felt that way. I just want that opportunity. And if there's any regret of my career, it's not getting that opportunity.
So when you started fighting in other places and you fought in Puerto Rico and different places, did you have concerns about your brain health and short term and long term?
No, because of Robert Cantu and Dr. Julian Bowles.
Okay.
I don't want people to think that I'm ignorant and I didn't do my homework or I didn't speak to other physicians or other surgeons. I didn't want people to think it sounded like that. They made it sound like my father manager doesn't care about me. They made it sound like I'm a stupid young punk that just wants to continue his career. And it did become part of a rights thing. It's my right. You know, who could stop me? It's my right. It did be that became a constitutional part of the legal battle. How do you get in the way of my rights? So that's the route our legal team took. But I don't want people to think that I just threw my arms up and said, I don't care what my injury is, I'm fighting. That's foolish. I investigated. I learned a little bit. I wanted to talk to physicians. I'd never met with a surgeon, a physician, an expert personally that examined me, and there was more than Bells and Cantu that said I shouldn't. There was not one doctor that said that I saw that you are at any greater risk now than your opponent. That's what is most important to me. Am I at any more, I know my risks as a boxer. Am I at any more, due to this injury, greater risk than my opponent? And I saw probably five nationally and internationally renowned surgeons, none of which told me that I would be at more risk.
So why couldn't you get a license with the big boys, Nevada, New York, New Jersey, those guys?
Well, those doctors on that board,
yep,
which are usually primary care doctors and internists and not neurosurgeons, maybe there might be one, but it is a good way for them, I think, to look like they care and they're being safe. You know, the Nevada State Athletic Commission and New York, throughout the years, I've been under a lot of scrutiny, not the best reputation sometimes. And it was a way for them to come out on the good side. And also because the Muhammad Ali Act, signed by Senator John McCain, who I love, but this was years earlier, deemed anyone who has a brain bleed can no longer be licensed. Is that, at the time, maybe the right thing to sign? Maybe, but I think today, I think he needs to be handled case by case. There are brain bleeds, and then there are brain bleeds. And if you think, and this is speculation, I shouldn't say fighters' names, but if you think a fighter at my level, and I was, how elite level was I? I don't even, at my level, didn't suffer a brain bleed, you're crazy. You think Larry Holmes, Evander Holyfield, Mike Tyson, Oscar De La Hoya, some of the biggest, best, never suffered a bleed? You're out of your mind crazy. They have to change the rules. Why do we get MRIs before the fight, not after? I mean, how do you know? These bleeds disappear. They dissipate. They go away. So I don't understand. I'm an advocate for safety, Tris. I want fighters to be safe. I'm an advocate for safety. Boxing's not going away, but if it's going to stay here like it is, then let's alter the rules. I know it's a cost thing, MRIs, but Luckily, I got an MRI, Tris. And luckily, I chose to go to my doctor and do it. If I ignored it, I was going to fight 90 days later. Whether it was Mike Tyson, Klitschko, I don't care who it was. Would I be sitting here with you? I don't know. Maybe not. I'm an advocate for safety. I went to the doctor. People need to be examined differently. You MRI Muhammad Ali's brain at the end of his life or after death, you're not going to see a bleed. You're going to allow him to fight. Does it mean he didn't have a bleed? Of course he did.
Hey, so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, Joe.
It's controversial. It's not an easy fix. I don't have the ideas of how to fix it.
No.
I just don't want to see any more of the people get hurt.
I think you're right, though. I mean, I think, you know, the MRI scans after fights would be super helpful. Let me ask you this about your symptoms of your brain bleed. Like, did you or do you suffer from any kind of headaches then in that aftermath or now? And any issues with short-term memory and that kind of stuff?
I do not have any issues. I do not. I never did have any issues. I would like to maybe, and this is something I've never said really publicly either, perhaps, and this is always to be questioned, perhaps some characteristic changes that maybe you would never, only my wife would know. I'm very obsessive, compulsive. I have things... I've always been that way. I'm a hard worker, but things that have been enhanced, some anxieties. Now it has me wondering, was it the injury? Because I wasn't always that way.
Right.
You're going to watch the movie Concussion with Will Smith and Alec Baldwin, who plays Julian Bales. And it's eye-opening to me, a fighter that has had an injury similar to what those pro football players have had. And... you know, bouts of depression, I've had that. But I don't know. We'll never know if it's related to the injury or is it life. I don't know.
Of course. So when you said bouts of depression, was the worst period for you in your life, that sort of 2005, 2006?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, is that injury or is that just the news that was bestowed upon me and the fact... You know what I mean? Because I bounced out of that.
Because I suppose your identity changes as well. You're no longer this fighter and prospect. You're the fighter with the brain bleed. Like, your identity changes.
Yeah, I think I still am. I still am, you know?
I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting, actually, you say that. I don't know what your identity is. I mean, you're the popular
heavyweight. If you bring my name up to somebody and I go to these certain boxing dinners or events, I think I'm the head injury guy.
Wow.
Okay. I don't know. I think so. And that's okay. That's my story. Yeah. You know, that's what, you know, God put me here. I believe spiritually God put me here. It was not to box, Tris. Boxing was the tool that God gave me to do good for others. Boxing means nothing to God, and it's this the gift he gave me, the tool, briefly in my life, to make me the man that I am and to give back to people.
Hey, so you had four fights in 2006, three in 2007, Puerto Rico, Louisiana, Arkansas, Michigan, and then that was it. Did you feel like you were some sort of renegade?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, upon hearing the news in Nevada, when I was in Nevada, and we basically won the Nevada state hearing, the Supreme Court case, through a loophole. The judge said, we can no longer suspend this kid, this fighter. The reason being is my license has expired. How are you suspending an unlicensed fighter?
Right.
So it was a loophole. And it said, so he is free to box. He is free to apply in any state he wants to that state's discretion. He's no longer banned from the sport. He just needs to apply. And if that state says yes, they say yes. So what we did strategically... through hearsay, is went to the states we knew that would license me.
Yeah. As in ones that have different scanning requirements and all that kind of stuff. Whatever you want to say.
Lesser known states that were very popular to host. I mean...
Yeah, you can see the fighters who wound up in some of... You mentioned Tommy there and, you know, that happens. You know, I'm writing a book on Matthew Saad Muhammad and he wound up in Fredericksburg, West Virginia and...
Sure.
You know, all these places.
I fought in West Virginia, Connecticut, Puerto Rico, you know, Arkansas. And back to the States that kind of were at the beginning of my professional career, you know, and you're getting on.
Yeah.
And the whole point was we are going to prove to Nevada. The states you need are Nevada and New York. Everybody knows that. The state I need is not Nevada, is New York.
Yeah.
Is Buffalo, New York. My goal, forget Nevada, my goal, as I mentioned earlier, is Buffalo, New York. That's where I make my money. I made more money here than I did fighting in MSG or Nevada. It doesn't matter. Those are wonderful showings. Financially speaking, my goal was to fight in Buffalo always, forever. Always bringing boxing back to Buffalo for my fans, my people, for me personally and selfishly, and to bring a world title fight, hopefully here to Buffalo. That was a goal. That's all we cared about. Forget Nevada. And HBO dropped me. They wouldn't have me on as a risk, but we're going to prove it to HBO, who was so good to me at one point. We're going to prove it to Nevada State Athletic Commission. And we thought that, and actually I thought that at the beginning, fighting in Puerto Rico first and then Arkansas. And I had to get in shape and prove myself and kind of come back, you know. I remember vividly in Connecticut, my last fight, and Shannon Miller, he's a young journeyman, you know. Probably my toughest test of that handful of fights there, though. And it was the fight that I felt back to good. You know, I felt really myself again. That didn't last but 30 seconds. And my team was celebrating, thinking that was it. Like, that was a televised fight against a decent prospect or a journeyman. And you physically are where, you know, that, and we're going to get calls. We're going to get back. And I remember being on the airplane home to my now wife, then fiance, whispering to her, saying, "I'm just done. We are not going to win this political battle, this political standoff, whether it's HBO, whether it's New York." And I was right. We never, ever would have won. And so I just never boxed ever again after that.
How hard was that letting go?
Not that hard.
No.
Not that hard that at that point. You know what? My fiance was sitting next to me. I said, I want to have kids. Let's get married. I want to. It's time for me to enter the real world. As a human being, as not a boxer, to finding a career, something I'm going to enjoy, it's time for me to do some homework. Boxing, I love this sport. I love the fighters. It made me disgruntled of a business I don't think I ever belonged in.
So do you feel like you found it easy to let go because you could let go on your terms to an extent and you had taken control and ownership and you were going out on your terms? Like, you could have carried on doing what you were doing, although it wouldn't have got you where you wanted to get, but you could still make the call yourself.
I don't think I've ever said it that perfectly. That's awesome. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. Yeah, just for me to now just disappear and walk away. I never had a press conference or retirement thing. I would never even put anyone out by doing something like that. I mean, I just wanted to disappear from the sport. Not from Buffalo, not my hometown, not anything like that. They were great memories. I was surprised even went as far as I did. Again, I was angry, and I wanted to walk away peacefully on my terms, like you said.
You mentioned Hassan Rahman. Were there offers to get you back from other places, or did people kind of accept once you'd gone, like, the phone stopped ringing and that kind of stuff?
They weren't good offers.
Okay.
Okay.
Nothing worthwhile.
No. Now, think back to 2007 and 8 and 9, Tris. You know, Should I box Kimbo Slice? You know what I mean?
Like those kind of things, yeah.
Financially, maybe would that have made sense? I would have been a circus. The brain-damaged kid's going to be, you know what I mean? Like, what is he, hungry for money? I didn't want people to think that of me. It's not the only reason I boxed, and I wasn't hungry for money. There's a quick email about Brock Lesnar for a second. Why don't I box him?
You box him.
I'd box Brock. He'd kill me in a UFC ring.
Yeah.
But I mean, but those are those are circuses. Those are jokes. Evander Holyfield. At that point, as much respect, I mean, he's my idol, but the old man versus the brain damaged kid. What does that make sense? What am I going to do that for? It doesn't do anything to my ranking. Doesn't, you know what? Riddick Bowe. What am I? Why would I do that?
Tyson offer ever come back around? Mike Tyson?
Not after 2007. No, no. Okay. No. We had some run-ins in Vegas and some events, and we hugged it out. And he said, "Man, that fight in Buffalo would have been great at the time." And wished me well, and he's a wonderful human being. But it wasn't until later, until recently, Tris, as you know, the trend of retired, older boxers. Now does it seem fitting for me, 40, going to be 49 years old? I mean, De La Hoya, isn't he training? I mean, Mike Tyson and all these guys that want to. I mean, you know, I don't know. Just give me a reason to lose 30 pounds, wouldn't it? I wouldn't do it.
Did you ever see or hear from Jirov again?
Yeah, we did one or two phone or even podcast interviews a couple years ago where we were on together.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was that?
Excellent.
Yeah?
It was a blast, actually. I know he trains in Arizona. I think he's got a gym. Is that correct?
I think that might be right. And I think last I heard, he's gone full vegan. Did you know that?
I did know that. Yeah. I saw him at an airport at a gate.
Okay.
This is going 10 years ago. Oh, God, the run-ins I have at airports. and I had to laugh and make fun of him. He was literally eating some grass something. And I had he was a health nut. Just like I said, tremendous guy, beautiful wife, and a great guy and a great fighter.
What was the best night of your career? Do you have a standout night?
Well, I think I'd have to say it would be DeVera Williamson. Because of so many things we talked about earlier, Tris, you know, DeVera, when I was a young amateur, I looked up to DeVera. He had been around a while. He had been doing the traveling thing with the U.S. teams. And he brought me under his wing and showed me how to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Not only that, many people don't know, he was heavyweight. As an amateur, I was super heavyweight, so we were sparring partners. He used to whoop me all the time. Taught me a lot inside the ring. Taught me a lot about the U.S. team. As we developed as professionals, kept an eye on each other. And then it came time to meet. And this is where I got to give my trainers credit. Because as watching these guys and these Robert Davises and these fighters that I might have known as an amateur and develop as a pro, and including Klebe, and they are still the same fighter they were then. Not to say they weren't good, but when they signed that contract, could you imagine what DeVera thought? Oh, my God, I'm going to go to Buffalo to fight Joe Macy. I'm going to embarrass this kid. Of course I'm going to take this fight. I used to knock this guy down. Why wouldn't he? And you want to know something? I didn't think it would be an easy fight, but I knew he was thinking that. And I thought to myself, look, I'm nervous, I'm scared, I look up to this guy, but I don't know, man, maybe I think I got something to show him. I'm not the same guy. And I was not. I wasn't, you know?
Do you have regrets about your career? If you could do it all over again, would you do things differently?
No, not one thing, not even the injury.
If you could do it all over again, would you do it again?
Absolutely.
You would.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
Okay.
I love the sport of boxing. It's the best thing. It's the best mistake I ever made.
Okay. And then I spoke to Chris Bird the other day for this podcast, and Chris told me that loads of the heavyweights were into PEDs and steroids and stuff. Do you think that was a big issue and is a big issue in boxing, particularly heavyweight boxing?
I'm sure it's an issue. It was not something I ever gave much concern. I don't think, this is my opinion, I don't think boxing is the right sport for steroids to help you. I question a lot. I might even question Morrison throughout his career. He's gone now, I can say that. It didn't help his stamina, did it? What is it going to help you with? You know, I don't know. I guess it would depend on the individual and their chemical makeup. But I don't see. It doesn't help your heart, does it? And boxing is a sport of will and who's got more heart. And I was a fighter with heart and determination with little skill. So what is steroids going to help with, you know?
I mean, I think you do yourself a disservice. Like, you don't get to where you got to with saying little skill.
Well, there's that too. I mean, there's that too. But, I mean, there are fighters. I look at boxing this way. You know, do I want to spend my money watching Floyd Mayweather? I'm a fight fan. I love Floyd Mayweather. I respect everything he does. He's the greatest ever lived. But I want to watch Holyfield fight. I want to watch Arturo Gatti fight. I want to watch fighters that are exciting like that. And Duran. I want to watch fighters that get knocked down and get up. You know, I want to watch fighters that, you know, I love Evander Holyfield. He was at his best when he was hurt. He was at his best when he was confused. He was most dangerous when he was tired. When you thought you had him, you didn't. And that's what Arturo Gatti did. And that's what fighters like that, that's why I love the sport. It's the guys that get knocked down and get up and say, this isn't over.
Do you have thoughts on the four leading the way today? Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua, Alexander Usyk, and Deontay Wilder. As in the four live heavyweights.
Oh, my God. It's thank God for these guys, because they are what giving the heavyweight division just the little bit of life, you know. I ran into Dante Wilder in a Las Vegas bathroom. Boy, is he big! But to tell you the truth, I've always loved Tyson, because when I look at what I know as boxing and what would fear me, he is exactly that. I would take Deontay Wilder any day of the week as a challenge over Tyson Fury. And I thought this from the beginning. He is so damn confusing. Even he doesn't know what he's going to do next. And that's what makes him great. And even more so, it's that heart and determination, that infamous knockdown, and he gets up. Man, I get chills right now thinking that that's what I love seeing. And it ain't over. You know, it's just not over yet.
What about Anthony Joshua?
I wish he's just one step away of being, he'd be such a great representative to the, not only the heavyweight division of the sport, because he is just such a likable fella. And he's what the heavyweight division needs in that sense. But I don't see anything too special. He deserves everything he's gotten to this point. I don't know how much more he's got.
Yeah, and he fights Usyk again in a couple of months.
Yeah.
Did you see the first fight with Usyk?
I saw some of the highlights.
Yep.
And, you know, I feel like Joshua has his days where he shows up and then he just doesn't. I don't see a lot of consistency. Doesn't make him not good or dangerous, because he sure is. I don't see that consistency.
And I think maybe he's struggling for an identity, which is something you never struggle for, really. Everyone... Well, I'm not saying you as the brain guy either. I'm saying that, you know, everyone knew what you were and what you brought to the table. And I think Joshua can be a mixed bag.
I never tried to prove that. It's some great defense, you know. I don't know what his real... He's just got a little bit of skill in every aspect, you know. Certainly got that incredible physique, but I don't know how much that helps you. But I wouldn't say, look, you got to be careful of this or that. I don't know what it is. You have to be careful with him. Is he going to be an easy fight for anyone, including myself? No, I wouldn't say it would be. But doesn't have that... when I watch that, what I feel when I see Fury, I'm like, geez, that guy... I don't know where I'd begin.
Yeah.
You know, he's got that about him. He throws punches when he's off balance. I don't even... he defies all of the rules. He does Muhammad Ali. Those two fighters in the heavyweight, they defy all the rules. Mm. This, what you're not supposed to do, they do, and they do it well.
At,
you know,
nearly 7 foot tall and
260
pounds.
I mean, completely awkward. I don't even know if he's right-handed, left-handed. I don't know what to expect.
Hey, so what do you do now then, Joe, with your life?
So,
did you make enough money to retire? Could you call it a day?
No. I did okay, but no. Part of my struggle was that identity. What am I going to do now with my life that I'm going to love and be passionate about? I don't care about money. I want to love and be passionate about, like I was passionate about boxing. I did go to college. Medical sales, medical device sales fell in my lap. Nothing falls in your lap. God has a purpose for me, and my path is my path. But for the last 13 years, I spend my days in the operating room selling medical devices to neurosurgeons, oddly enough.
Wow.
I sit in on subdural hematoma injuries. And if you want to laugh about this full circle, I sell instruments to neurosurgeons for the spine, for the head. And I see subdural hematomas, fatal subdural hematomas. I see some serious subdural hematomas. So I've gained a little bit of knowledge about head injuries. I'm not an expert or a physician, but mind you, I'm just a salesman. But it's really funny how God works, and this is what I do.
That is crazy. Do you enjoy it?
I love it so much. I can't tell you how much I love it. And this is the path God put me on. How ironic that I do what I do, that he's given me. I would never be doing this today without boxing. I love to speak at schools still locally. I love to give back to this community. If any way I could raise money or raise awareness for a cause, I like to do that. I'm still somewhat, believe it or not, like an ambassador of this town. And I love that title because if there's anything I love more than boxing, it's Buffalo. I love the 2 and 2 put together. And the little involvement I do have, speaking of Tony Holden, we have recently reconnected.
Okay.
And he and I are trying to bring world-class boxing back to Buffalo. ESPN has gotten a hold of us, and we're trying to bring him back to Buffalo, New York. So he and I together.
Wow, that's great. And it's great to see you in a good place and sort of fully accepting that you're into the well and truly into the next chapter. And now, like, I had a snoop in your Instagram, and like, just seemed to be living a happy family life. And like you say, really, life is when you, and I know what you mean about the missing boxing, but not missing the business.
Yeah, that's the best way I could put it.
Yeah, I've said that same thing many times.
That's the best way I could put it. There are things I miss, there are people I miss, my team, my trainer. I mean, I've flown on private plush jets and got to do such wonderful things. I've also met fighters that are fighting for the next meal money. You know, like I have just from one end to the other, I've just met some great people. I've gotten to see all aspects of life. I've been to 15 countries because of this wonderful sport, and it's given me the knowledge and the maturity and the know-how to, there's nothing I can't accomplish now. You know, I'm a top salesman. I'm not even a salesman, Tris, okay? But I'm a top salesman now in my company, and I love what I do, and I love the anatomy. I'm learning things now that I never thought I'd be opening up my eyes to. But, you know, it's when I'm asked, you know, what is my involvement with boxing now? I don't have a lot of involvement. I wouldn't be a good trainer. I'm a good student. I'm not a good teacher. I wouldn't be a good manager. I don't think that would be my role. I don't know. I don't use my name locally. I don't own a boxing gym. I often kick myself. Why didn't I, like, stay involved? On the other hand, Tris, I think I didn't need to. You know, boxing's not the only thing I want to hang my hat on. You know, I got a wonderful family, and I got this career. Would I promote a fight? I would do that. That's more my specialty, the marketing aspect.
Would you let your kids box?
For exercise, yes. For fitness, sure. I would never stop them if they wanted to make a career of anything. I don't have to worry about that. My two daughters aren't going to box, and my son. My son, Joseph, is a most unique, complex, special needs son. He's the blessing of my life, and I've learned more from my 10-year-old son that I've learned from boxing. So, but I don't have to worry about that.
I mean, never say never with the girls, right?
That's true. I do have a tough 12-year-old girl who's a wonderful gymnast.
Because the you know, in many ways, the girls' sports putting the guys' sport to
it's
shame.
It's true.
In a lot of different ways,
especially right in now. The UFC too. Man, some of the most exciting. I'm not a big fan. I don't watch it.
We had the
Katie Taylor fight with Amanda Serrano selling out Madison Square Garden in record time as well recently. So
yeah,
it's big business.
You and know, Holmes being inducted this year was...
in fact, it's the first class of the female fighters being inducted into Canastota this year.
And so, deservingly so, because she's excellent. She's awesome.
Well, there's Lucia, Holly Holm, and Christy Martin all being inducted.
That's right. I was there for Christy, yeah.
So it's all good stuff. But yeah, Joe, well, thank you so much for making the time to see me. It's great to meet you, and thanks for the interview. It's been fantastic.
And it's great to meet you, man. And thank you so much, Tris. You've got to have some stories and knowledge, man, with all of the interviews and traveling you've done, right?
I'm trying, man. I'm trying.
That's
I'm building up a database. It's getting
good
there.
For you,
it's
man.
Getting there.
Good for you. Well, I'm a big fan and follower now, so thank you. Thank you for having
me. Thanks, Joe. Thank you.
All right.
So I thought Joe was wonderful, honest to a fault. It was really interesting on many levels, especially the stuff about the research he did trying to find out whether he should fight again. Too often you think about boxers being pig-headed and wanting to fight again just despite the risks. But Joe's approach was very different, very measured, even if it did cause him to wind up in that Tommy Morrison bracket on a random bill. Huge thanks to Joe for taking the time to talk to me. Really appreciated it. And I really appreciate Hanson Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Please drop Blaz and the gang a line. You can get me on Patreon at patreon.com/TrisDixon, which is also a good place to reach me. And there's my future episodes up with trainer Aaron Snowell talking about that famous night when he was in the corner when Mike Tyson lost to James Buster Douglas. And referee Tony Weeks, who talks about owning the bloodiest shirt in all of boxing and being the third man in the middle for the fight between Diego Corrales and Jose Luis Castillo. Next week is Tony Weeks. He's the first referee on the podcast since Mickey Van, and it's an absolute belter. Don't miss it. We'll be back next week.